Welcome to the May 2014 issue of Dialogues in Dermatology. The American Academy of Dermatology is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. The American Academy of Dermatology designates this enduring material for a maximum of 2 AMA PRA Category 1 credits. Physicians should claim only the credit commensurate with the extent of their participation in the activity. This activity is recognized by the American Academy of Dermatology for 2 AAD recognized credits and may be used toward the AAD CME Award. Participation in this activity is completed by listening to dialogues on CD or a downloaded MP3 file, achievement of a 70% or higher score on the post-test, and completion of an activity evaluation. The date of original release for this issue is May 2014. The expiration date is April 2017. At the conclusion of this learning activity, participants should be able to identify patient populations that are most at risk for melanoma. Recognize the benefit of baseline imaging to assist with early detection of melanoma. Advise patients on how to use sunscreen and identify which types of sunscreens reduce the risk of melanoma. And identify the benefits and risks of new therapeutics available to treat advanced melanoma. Contributors to this issue of Dialogues in Dermatology have disclosed the following financial relationships. Dr. Deanne Mraz Robinson has served as principal investigator for and received grants and research funding from Allergan, Inc., Cabocon, and Cynosure, Inc. Dr. Delphine Lee has served as principal investigator for and received fees from Allergan and has been a stockholder and received no compensation from Biogen. Dr. Daryl Regal has served on the advisory board for and received honoraria from Beiersdorf, Inc., Genentech, Inc., Elio Pharma US, and Melasciences. He has been a speaker for and received honoraria from Genentech, Inc. He has been a consultant for and received honoraria from Elio Pharma US, Medicis Pharmaceutical Corporation, Melasciences, and Valiant Pharmaceuticals International. All other contributors, including editors, interviewees, reviewers, and staff, reported they have no relevant relationships with commercial interests. A comprehensive list of disclosed financial relationships is available in the syllabus.
Welcome back to Dialogues in Dermatology. This is Terry Cronin, your editor-in-chief. This is Dialogues in Dermatology for May 2014, Volume 70, Issue 5. This month, in order to celebrate Skin Cancer Detection and Prevention Month, we have three timely dialogues regarding early diagnosis of melanoma, prevention of melanoma, and new therapies for advanced melanoma. Melanoma represents the malignancy with the fastest growing incidence in the U.S. and is a crucial public health issue that we as dermatologists must relentlessly address. At current rates, approximately 1 in 50 Americans will be diagnosed with invasive melanoma over their lifetime. In our first dialogue this month, we join Dr. Daryl Regal and Dr. Jane Yu, who will educate us on the early diagnosis of melanoma.
This is Jane Yu from Dialogues in Dermatology, and I have the distinct honor of being here with Dr. Daryl Regal. He's done a tremendous amount for our field as he served as past president of the AAD, ASDS, as well as the ADA. He's also served for almost a decade as director of the American Board of Dermatology. Thank you so much for being here today to give us an update on skin cancer.
It's my pleasure to be here, Jane.
So, Dr. Regal, how have melanoma rates changed in the past couple of decades?
Melanoma, unfortunately, is rising dramatically in terms of incidence. And despite everything we're doing, trying to get the word out and protect people, it's not working. Rates since 1980 have basically tripled in the U.S. And we're not just seeing in the U.S., we're seeing this in almost all developed countries in the world where melanoma rates continue to rise, incidence rates. In terms of survival, the good news is that we're starting to have higher survival rates in the U.S. They've gone up from probably in the mid-80s percent during the 1980s, as well as to now the mid to upper 90 percent, certainly for early melanomas. But despite that, the number of people dying from melanoma is still going up. And it's estimated this year there'll be almost 9,500 Americans who will die from melanoma. So we need to get better on the secondary prevention, the early detection, to really impact on that mortality rate.
Can you tell me specifically who may be at risk for melanoma, what types of risk factors there are, and whether you are seeing a rise in incidence in any particular group?
Well, typically we think of the phenotypic risk factors that we have now, fair-skinned, light eyes, light hair, people who sunburn easily or tan poorly. Certainly those are all risk factors. People who had intense sun exposure early in life and had blistering sunburns, the more of those you have, the greater the risk you have. So most all of the factors we look at right now are sun-related or family history-related. If you have a family history, especially a first-degree relative, your risk goes up dramatically. Combining all those factors make it goes up even more. In the future, we're hoping that we'll be able to get genotypically in terms of risk factors, and it's probably a combination of the two. It's probably susceptibility and environmental exposure that really raises your risk overall. We just don't have the second piece of it yet to really be effective.
Now, a lot of us, our patients ask us about questions about sunscreen. Can you tell us the difference between chemical and physical blockers and how you counsel your patients who may really want to wear sunscreen year-round?
Well, that's a great thing, and it comes up all the time. And of course, the terminology chemical and physical has now been replaced with inorganic and organic sunscreens. Yeah. But at the end of the day, basically the same idea. The so-called physical or inorganic sunscreens are typically made with micronized particles of zinc or titanium, zinc oxide or titanium dioxide. And what these basically do is primarily they do reflect the light back. So if you look at an absorption curve or a reflectance curve for these types of sunscreens, it's flat because they're reflecting all the light across. Unfortunately, they do reflect some of the light down. So it comes through and it may just deflect it as opposed to reflect it. So that's how the rays get through in some cases with this. And in fact, they can also denature. The way they denature is they clump. So if they don't, even if they microscopically clump, you're not getting a good, complete, even exposure. And the other disadvantage is because they're on the surface, they often can just wash off. They're not as sweat resistant or water resistant to that. So that's the pluses and minuses of those. Of the so-called chemical or organic sunscreens, they basically work by absorbing the ultraviolet energy and actually converting it to red light. Now, of course, you don't see that when you're outside, it's bright, you're not going to see somebody glowing red, but it's a very low-level red light, and it converts it to an energy level that's not going to be as harmful in the skin. Again, the advantages of these are a little more sweat-resistant. They are absorbed in the upper layer of the skin. The disadvantage is they're absorbed in the upper layer of the skin. So there is some systemic absorption of these, which we really, probably not a problem, but we don't know that 100% for sure. Also, the disadvantages or advantage, depending on how you look at it, is you can design these sunscreens to protect more in UVA or more in UVB or both, so you can better engineer what you're trying to get out of them.
Great. Thank you. How do you talk to your young female patients about the risk of tanning beds? We've seen a rise in incidence in tanning, and can you tell us about any recent legislative changes that have come in the past a couple of years?
We could spend the whole interview on tanning issues because it's so important, and it's so sad because we are seeing young women, primarily in their 20s, who have melanoma in places where the sun doesn't typically shine but are exposed in tanning beds. And there are a lot of them. And almost every woman I see who has melanoma in her 20s reports a history of tanning bed exposure. So, in fact, I like to call them tanning coffins instead of tanning beds because it gets the message across a little better. It is a significant problem. People still like to tan. The tanning industry is very powerful. It's estimated that there are probably 28 million Americans a year go to tanning beds. 1 million Americans a day are going to a tanning salon. It's an incredible number. And the reality is part of this, to really be effective, I think we have to change social mores about how people want to look. They should like the skin they're in. They don't have to look darker necessarily to be better. But this starts primarily in prom season when all these tanning bed companies have all these specials, pre-prom specials and all these sorts of things. And you look at the data, it's kind of scary. A recent study among high school seniors showed that almost 35% of young girls, high school senior females, had gone to a tanning bed at least six times in the prior year. That really is the problem. When you're that age, it's hard to say, gee, you're going to die from this later on. It's like cigarette smoking in a lot of ways. You don't see the result right away, so you can't relate to it. But we do try to tell them it's bad, and there is no such thing as a safe tan. In order to tan, your body has to sense it's being injured and then produce the melanin to try to protect itself. So to get tan, you have to be injured. Unfortunately, I see the people who've had the melanomas. At that point, they wish they hadn't done it. But it's really hard to get through to that group. The Academy is looking at a lot of ways of doing it. And I'd say if anybody listening has any good suggestions, contact the Melanoma Skin Cancer Committee on the Academy, because we're always looking at ways to do this.
Now, when a patient comes to your office with multiple nevi, how do you document or keep track of these changing lesions?
There's a number of ways to do this, and typically we use baseline imaging. So we'll take somebody who's got high risk, in other words, multiple dysplastic nevi, history of melanoma, prior or family history of melanoma, and we will get full body imaging of them. These are usually high resolution digital images, and we'll follow the patient on a baseline way, typically twice a year or so. Unless they have a extreme high risk group, we might see them every 3 or 4 months. But the idea behind that is, if you have a good set of baseline images, you can detect change. There's a bunch of ways to do this. There are formal software packages and camera packages that can be used. We just basically go back with the original images and compare them on the screen. But the reality is they are quite effective in seeing change. And of course, we know the E of ABCDE is evolving or change. And change is a very important component, as we know, in terms of making sure that we can see if something is suspicious for biopsy.
Now, what are the current methods of melanoma detection that dermatologists can utilize?
Well, obviously, the tried and true way of dealing with this is just looking. And preface this by saying nothing replaces a good set of eyes. And no matter what device you have at this point, a good set of eyes is still the best. There are a number of studies that show that the longer you've been in practice, the better you are at this. When we first developed the ABCDs of melanoma, our group at NYU in 1985, we did it because we had a series of photographs of obvious melanomas, and we were trying to describe what early melanoma looked like. And we showed these images to, at the time, senior attendings and said, "What are they?" And they'd invariably say melanoma. And if we asked, "Well, why?" the answer was, "Because it looks like one." And with enough experience, it is kind of a gestalt thing. But when you're first starting out, you have to learn what the template is. That was the idea behind the ABCDs, now ABCDEs. But there's still room for improvement. A lot of new techniques are out there. Certainly in the 1990s, we began with dermoscopy, and that has grown dramatically in the opportunities that are there. There's some new computer-aided devices that are out there looking at a variety of other things. Confocal microscopy is one. The advantage is it's very accurate in the sense of looking at the images, looking down into the skin. One of the disadvantages, it takes a little longer to get the answers out. You have to be fairly have a good technician to do the imaging for you. It's a little technically challenging sometimes. Another device is multispectral digital skin lesion analysis, which is a device that's been shown using different small, narrow bandwidths of light to analyze a variety of lesions to determine whether or not they're of high or low disorganization. There was a wonderful study that was done several years ago in Austria where they took expert dermoscopists, dermatologists, and they went up against primary care physicians who were given a diagnostic device, a computer-aided device. And at the end of the study, the dermoscopist had a sensitivity for finding melanoma of 96%. While the PCPs with the device only had 72%. And the reason they didn't do as well is they didn't know what to image. So still, a patient comes in with 100 lesions, you can't image 100 lesions. You'll have to have some clinical skills and expertise to determine the subset you want to look at. Devices like these are particularly useful when you're on the fence, should I biopsy, should I not biopsy? It's also good when the patient comes in with a solitary lesion that might be in a cosmetically sensitive area. And it might help you, do I need to biopsy this or not, before you go ahead and do that. So there are a bunch of secondary applications. But at the end of the day, what's going to happen, I believe, in the near future, is that the way we diagnose melanoma is going to change. By using devices like these and augmenting our ability to do what we do now, we're going to get better at it.
That sounds terrific. And can you give us an example then? How would it work in a busy office setting that you have?
Well, number one, typically when the patient comes in with multiple lesions, and especially if we have baseline imaging for them, and something has changed, we'll want to check it to see the degree of disorganization. So that's number one. Number two, we'll use it primarily in women, but it could be in either group who have a lesion on a cosmetically sensitive area like a face, so they have a lentigo that they want to lighten. And in the past, we probably would have biopsied a corner of it before we lasered it. Now the device is sensitive enough, if we're comfortable with that, we can use the laser and not have the cosmetic defect we might have from a little biopsy for that. And the third thing is kind of for reassurance. when that patient calls up on Monday morning and decides, I've been worrying about this all weekend, that I have a mole that's bothering me, come on in. We can look at it. If we really don't want to biopsy it, we can say, let's see what the machine thinks. And in a sense, that reassures the patient. It gives them additional reassurance. So those kind of the three ways we kind of integrated into our practice.
Thank you. And finally, if you had a crystal ball and could see, you know, melanoma diagnosis in the near future, how do you think the landscape would change?
Well, it's very clear that early diagnosis of melanoma is what makes a difference. Marty Weinstock gave a wonderful presentation at the Academy meeting on the importance of primary versus secondary prevention. Primary prevention is stay out of the sun, wear sunscreen, protective clothing. And that really impacts on the incidence of melanoma. But early detection really impacts on the mortality of melanoma, because if you're going to get it, we know we can detect it early. And melanoma is a perfect example of a cancer to focus on early detection, secondary prevention, because if you catch it early, you treat it early, no big deal. Once it spreads, really hard to treat. So since it's so black and white, it's easy to focus on that area. And I think that's where it's going to be at. All the tools that we're going to be getting will be focusing on making us better at early detection. And if we do that, we really can impact on mortality.
Well, thank you so much for being here today, Dr. Riegel, and thank you for your wonderful commentary on an update on melanoma and diagnosis.
My pleasure. It's always a pleasure to do this.
Over 75,000 cases of invasive melanoma and over 55,000 of melanoma in situ will be diagnosed this year. In addition, more than 9,000 Americans will die from melanoma this year. The one bright note in the subject of melanoma is the steady improvement in the 5-year survival for invasive melanoma, which was 82% in 1979, but has improved to 92% in 2002. Until recently, treatment modalities besides surgical excision have done little to prolong survival, and the noted improvements in survival can primarily be attributed to early detection. While nothing can replace a good set of eyes in conjunction with basic clinical guidelines such as the ABCDs and E's of melanoma, technological advances continue to provide avenues for improvement in melanoma detection. Dermoscopy or epiluminescence microscopy is one of the earliest of these technological advances. Since the 1990s, improvements in portability and features such as cross-polarized light filters have popularized the use of dermatoscopes by dermatologists. Another practical modality is the use of high-resolution full-body photography for, quote, mole mapping. This simple approach can be invaluable in following patients with numerous dysplastic nevi by facilitating early detection of new lesions and the slightest of changes in already present lesions. Confocal microscopy is another non-invasive imaging modality that allows us to evaluate pigmented lesions in vivo with fairly good resolution. This technique has gained popularity among some experts. However, it has been limited by the need for often slow and bulky specialized equipment and a steep learning curve in interpreting images. Even newer technology includes multispectral digital imaging modalities paired with computer software to aid differentiation between melanoma and benign pigmented lesions. While ease of use and interpretation of results are clear benefits, the usefulness of this technology is dependent on knowing exactly which lesions should be imaged. For example, studies have shown that dermatologists who are expert dermatoscopists have better melanoma detection rates compared to primary care providers using a computer-aided device. Epidemiologic studies have helped us identify individuals with the highest risk for developing melanoma. These include individuals with fair complexion, light eyes and hair, history of sunburns or tanning bed use, and history of a first-degree relative with melanoma. Emerging technologies for surveillance and early detection of melanoma may become useful in following these higher-risk individuals. They will hopefully improve our diagnostic confidence and possibly spare patients unnecessary biopsies, especially in cosmetically sensitive areas. The future looks promising in our fight against melanoma. Initiatives focused on primary prevention are certainly crucial to decrease the incidence of melanoma. These should focus on public education, sun protection, and public policies to address the epidemic of tanning bed use. Importantly, future tools will continue to focus on early detection.